I really hesitate to use a term such as white brotherhood because there are so many stupid people who think they will start up a cult called the White Brotherhood, or the Dark Donkeys or something else. There are so many sick people nowadays that they seize on anything which they feel might sound plausible. But there is a definite group of entities. And you cannot take a correspondence course with them and you will not find them associated with any of these crazy cultists on this earth. Who come down to this world, and of course also go to other worlds, to set an example as teachers. It would be such a waste of time if they had to get born here when all they have to do would take, perhaps, a year. So they take over a specially prepared body, and when their task is done the body disappears in some way which we need not discuss here. You always talk about humans and animals. Are we not animals too? Yes, of course we are, not very nice animals either, some of us. But I am merely following what one might term a pattern in referring to humans and animals. It makes it clear that I am referring to one species, human or another species, say cat. And, as I have been telling you previously, Miss Cleopatra is the most intelligent person I know, no matter whether we are going to consider animal or human. Please tell us how to use a crystal. I would like to see the answer to that one in your next book. Should we make the room pitch dark before we experiment? Should we put the glass in a safe place so that it won't be used for other purposes? Should we use a little imagination in the matter of making something appear, or what? Well, I really thought I had made the matter very clear on how to use a crystal. Now, supposing you do not have a crystal, supposing you use a glass of water instead, well, you get a new glass. An absolutely plain glass without any pattern on it, without any etching, without any scratches, in fact, a fairly expensive glass which has no flaws so far as you can see. Then you carefully wash it, and when you have rinsed off all the soap suds you fill it with water right up to the top so that you've got a meniscus. The meniscus is that bump which appears when you slightly overfill the glass. The glass full of water is now set on a table or somewhere dark, and you make sure that your room is dark or dim. Obviously you must be able to see the glass, you must be able to see your hands in front of you, but you do not need to be able to see to read the newspaper. I give you that just as a guide. The correct amount of darkness is when colors begin to disappear. Having the right conditions, you breathe deeply a few times and settle yourself so that you are comfortable. There must be no strain, no muscle which is twitching, no nerve which is flapping. And then you gaze in the direction of the glass of water, but you do not gaze actually at it, you look through it with your eyes unfocused. Imagine that you are focusing on infinity. Got that clear? You are looking in the direction of the glass and you are deliberately defocusing your eyes, imagining that you are looking at some invisible spot in space. You just sit there letting your mind take over, and the first thing you will notice is cloudiness. The water seems to turn milky white, and then, provided you do not jerk or fall off your chair with shock, the milky whiteness dissipates and then you see pictures. And that is all there is to it. You do not have to imagine things. Why should you when you can see the real things? After you have used your glass you tip out the water, you rinse it and dry it, and then you wrap it up in a black cloth and you use it for nothing else at all. If you are using a crystal then you do the same in the matter of gazing at it, but after you have used it you wrap it up in a black cloth, because if bright sunlight falls upon it you will spoil its power in much the same way as if you allow sunlight to fall on a film which has been unrolled. The thing will be no good after. I would like to know what you think of gambling? Well, that's easy. I have said that several times in my books. I am completely opposed to gambling. And although quite frequently people will send me sweepstake tickets and all that sort of thing, I have never in my life won anything at all, not even a cent, so there. I cannot seem to find out whether zone for cats is in the astral world. How do you go about finding such zones? You have just been taking me to task in a previous question, saying why do I refer to humans and animals, because aren't humans animals as well? So now you want to know the zone for animals, so let me say to you, aren't humans animals as well? And if humans can go to a zone, why can't four-legged animals? The answer is they can. Miss Gray and Mrs. Fifi Gray Whiskers are great friends of mine. They are in the astral plane waiting for me. I have another girl cat friend there called Cindy, and Cindy comes down to this earth in actual physical form to see me and to give me messages. That is perfectly true. So let me tell you that animals, if they are of sufficient spiritual status, can go to any plane of existence to which humans of the same status can go. In other worlds, you know, animals are not treated as inferior creatures, they are not dumb animals any longer on other worlds, and to a person who is telepathic, as I am, there is no such thing as a dumb animal. While we are talking about animals, does it ever occur to you that the only bad or vicious animals are those who have been made so by humans? Normally animals are born good and they stay so unless messed up by humans. So the answer to your question is this: animals do go to the same zones as humans, so when you pass over, quite definitely you can be met by an animal you love and WHO loves you. The last few days here have been very, very hot, unbearably hot, in fact. But now at this moment the temperature has dropped about 30 degrees and we are having a thunderstorm, and some poor souls are getting married, or probably they are already married. It is a strange custom here in Calgary that when a couple has just been married and are driving along away from the place of marriage, they make as much commotion as they can. The bridal car and all the cars attached to that bridal retinue have horns sounding all the time, and the uproar is truly formidable. I can't see any sense in it personally, because how is it going to help a marriage to have blaring horns disturbing everyone? Another thing that puzzles me here in Calgary is the fire department, the police and the ambulances. They have the loudest sirens I have ever heard anywhere. Not only that, but the ambulance sirens wobble and really could just about scare a nervous patient to death. Where I live there is a sort of conjunction of concrete buildings, and for some strange reason the sound echoes and re-echoes and echoes again, and quite truly seems to be increased in volume because of some architectural idiosyncrasy. Anyway, the noise goes on day and night, and here the traffic is unceasing. I have never seen the road outside without loads of cars. Throughout the whole of the 24 hours of the day and night there is a continuous flow of fast cars, and I often lie in my bed and look out of the window and wonder where all the people are going, unceasingly moving the whole time non-stop, day and night. There are too many cars here and too much noise. But I suppose some will write to me now and say I am jealous because I haven't a car or something. People do that, you know, people write and tell me I am bitter. I didn't know it, I don't feel that I am bitter. I have my own problems and I cope with them as best I can, so there it is. When I was in the hospital last time, I had a learner Christian chaplain come and try to con me into a bit of religion, and before I said anything except that I was a Buddhist, he said, "Oh, and do you feel guilty about it, or bitter that you are not a Christian? So what do you think about that?" I could have replied, "No, but you look a bit guilty about being a Christian." It does seem so strange that so many doctors and so many parsons try to cough up a sort of pseudo-psychology. They try to analyze one's behavior entirely on textbook learning, and they forget that a Buddhist may have a different outlook on life than does a Christian. But let's get back to some of these questions and answers. But first of all, let me read you something from a letter written to me by Mr. Bodlanchland. He says, "I am happy to learn that you are writing a 15th book. I don't know how to tell you how much your books have meant to us. If they weren't true, I should lose all confidence in my ability to judge what to accept and what to reject. To you, perhaps your aura work is the most important mission in this life, but I think that by writing your books and letting people in on some of the mysteries of life that some of us have been fumbling about trying to solve, you have done far more good for humanity than by proving that there is an aura and that it can be photographed well." Mr. Langeland, yes, you have my definite, definite assurance that all my books are absolutely true. These books are not fiction, they are truth. Not just truth as I see truth, but actuality truth. Yes, The great 13th Dalai Lama did indeed bless me by placing both of his hands on my head in a special manner. That in a special manner is important because a very, very gifted man as was the great 13th can pass on special powers. He can, in effect, speed up one's vibrations. This, by the way, is in answer to someone who wants to know about such things. You probably know that years ago in England and, in fact, in many countries there was a quite definite belief that the king could cure illness, and if a king placed his hands on a sufferer then the sufferer would be cured. You get the same thing in the legend about Jesus, where if a person could touch the robe which Jesus wore, then he or she would be cured of all illness. It is because such people have a different vibration, and when they see by their superior knowledge that another person has possibilities for improvement and a possibility for accepting an increase in vibration, they do that necessary gesture which does give the recipient an ineffable sense of well-being and power. And I am going to tell you that my abilities increased enormously from that act by the Dalai Lama. You ask why one hand or whiter hands. You tell me that people who go to church and get blessed every Sunday don't seem to be any better or any worse because of it. Well, that is right enough. The great 13th used two hands in the same way that if you have an electric device you have to have two wires, two contacts, because just one would not pass any current. As for your saying that people who go to church are not improved by being touched with one hand or two hands, no, that is just what I have been telling you. You only get benefit if the person doing the touching is a superior person, not some poor parson or cleric who is just doing mumbo jumbo because it's the easiest sort of job he knows, and anyway he doesn't know anything else. Oh no, as far as benefit comes from such a thing, you could go out and ask anyone in the street to touch you on the head, you would be just as well off. You ask what causes the sun's rays to be reflected so brightly from the moon. We have sent men to the moon and they have discovered that the moon is not made of green cheese but of rocks and sand, very similar to what is here on Earth. When the sun's rays hit a high mountain top on Earth early in the morning or late at night, the valley below remains in darkness. Since the rocks on the mountain top are similar to the rocks on the moon, why don't they reflect the rays down into the valley? Easy, my dear sir, easy. The surface of the moon is very similar in its reflective power to that of gypsum, and gypsum, which is like plaster of Paris, does indeed reflect. But in the case of the moon, the reflection is aided enormously because there is no air to absorb the light rays. Light rays, you know, consist of vibrations, and if there is air then the vibrations are slowed by passage through that atmosphere. The moon, as we know, has no atmosphere. Thus the rays from the sun reach the moon unimpeded and are reflected unimpeded from the moon's surface. You ask about rocks on Earth, why do they not reflect the sun's rays down into the valley? The answer to that is because the angle of incidence is different. You see, when you get rays of light coming down to mountain tops, the rays are reflected upwards, or within a narrow arc, they are not reflected downwards. And you can easily try this out for yourself by having a fairly powerful light bulb suspended from the ceiling, and that will represent the Sunday. Then you sit on the floor with a hand mirror in your hand. You can then reflect the sun's rays, actually the suspended lamp, back onto the ceiling or fairly high up on the walls around you, but without very acrobatic contortions you cannot reflect the rays down between your feet, which will be considered as the valley. Is that clear? The third question from this gentleman is a sensible one, so let's answer it. He says, you write that wars are necessary to control the population explosion and to give people an opportunity for self-sacrifice. What is the karmic effect on such war heroes who perhaps give up their own life fighting for their country but in the process kill or maim many of their enemies that they have never even seen before? When, or if, they should meet again somewhere in the hereafter, would they ask, are you the SOB who killed me? And how does someone gain merit for fighting a war and killing someone even if they lose their own life? The laws of karma are different when a person is fighting in defense of his home, his family and his country, so that if you are ordered into the forces you really have no choice, you have to go. And once you are in the forces, you come under a blanket protection so that the people who give the orders, basically the governments, have to accept the karmic results of those orders. You, Private AB, are sent to the war front. You have a rifle in your hands, and at a certain time you may be told to fire that rifle. You have to obey your orders or you may get killed for disobedience. So you pull the trigger and a bullet kills one of the enemy. The karmic effect of it is not yours, you do not have to worry about it. The karmic effect is assumed by the person or persons who actually caused the war. When you get to the other side, you do not have to meet the person you killed or the person who killed you. Only if you have no dislike and no hatred of those persons can you meet them. Certainly you can gain merit by preventing atrocities. Suppose a little troop of men are able to ambush members of the opposition, the enemy, who are setting out to massacre a lot of women and children. Perhaps they were going to set fire to the houses after they had locked the inhabitants inside. Well, you and your small troop could kill perhaps 20 members of the assassination gang, but in doing so you would have saved possibly 2,000 women, children, and old people, so the balance would be to the good, wouldn't it? And under that heading you would have gained merit. Mrs. Nancy Justice is an old friend of mine. We have been corresponding for I forget how long, but it's quite a long time. Now she writes in and she has some questions. So I think we ought to attend to Mrs. Nancy Justice, don't you? She says, I am slightly clairvoyant. In your book Wisdom of the Ancients you define clairvoyance as seeing through walls and beyond. What I mean is knowing what is going to happen before it happens. But I can do this to a limited degree only. I have an urge to crystal gaze or something of that sort. I know mirrors seem to draw my eyes, and I read somewhere of mirrors that were used once upon a time where they painted one side or something. Could you tell me how to do this? Well, Mrs. Justice, I have just been writing about crystals and how to use them. So I think that actually does answer most of your question, but very definitely I would not advise you to use a black mirror, because if used carelessly they are very, very dangerous things indeed and enable mischievous entities to work harm through you. So take my advice and have nothing whatever to do with these black mirrors. A crystal cannot harm you in any way at all. You go on, I see that you talk a lot about the astral and traveling by astral. Also, I believe you when you say that no harm can come to you, but I am one of those strange persons who is deathly afraid of hypnotism, even self-hypnosis. What I wanted to ask you is it true that when you are deeply engrossed in reading something, like reading a book to the point that you are not aware of outside influence, well, that is a form of hypnosis. No harm can happen when you are doing astral travel unless you are afraid. But then you can be harmed if you take fright, even if you are crossing the road. You might run the wrong way. I am definitely opposed to hypnosis. I am also opposed to self-hypnosis because it is so easy to do it the wrong way, easier to do it the wrong way than it is to do it the right way, in fact. So stay clear of all forms of hypnosis, they are bad. But rest quite assured that when you are reading a book you are not hypnotized. Instead you are merely interested and that is absolutely safe. You give a third question, Mrs. Justice, and it is so applicable that I am going to answer it here now. You're right, you keep saying that to try all the different things in your book that nothing will ever happen to you, like being possessed. Fine, but how did those people who are possessed get that way? What did they do or not do? That's a fair enough question. But you will remember just above that I have been telling you not to do hypnosis. I have been telling you not to use black mirrors. So if you do and try these things, then you can easily get possessed. I am telling you throughout all my books how not to get possessed, and if you follow what I write then you cannot get possessed. But if you disregard what I am saying then you will get possessed, which is what you want to know about. Black mirrors, black magic, hypnosis and some of those Ouija boards can lead you astray. You can get hypnotized with them, you can get possessed. And this is why I say time after time don't do it. Chapter 12. Everyone here is very busy, Normally I like to type a lot of my books myself and then have Buttercup retype them on her Olympia typewriter. Henry Mendelssohn gave me a typewriter which I have named the Yellow Peril, but I have not been able to use it much on this book, my health has not permitted, and so most of this book has been dictated on a Sony tape recorder, just a small pocket thing, so I can claim kinship with Mr. Nixon. He used Sony recorders for his Watergate tapes, I believe. Buttercup is a marvelous typist, extremely fast and extraordinarily accurate. It is a matter of much jubilation when she makes a mistake, because it's nice to tell her that she is not perfect after all. But we hear a tramp resident so a very great deal to Buttercup, and without her we should have a much harder time. So thank you, Buttercup Rouse. Mrs. Ramper is a hard worker, too. She goes through the pages of the typescript with an eagle eye, and between them Buttercup and Mrs. Ramper not many mistakes get by, and if I make a mistake in my dictation, my goodness me, I never hear the last of it. Buttercup comes on me like 10 tons of bricks, and there is no peace until I have rectified the error of omission or commission or some other mission. My sympathy, though, goes to the poor wretched typesetters who have to set up books, because it must be a horrifying thing indeed to have to set up in print a book which you find boring or in which you just can't get any interest. I would just hate to be a typesetter. As I am sitting here in my wheelchair, I can see our little river outside, and there are two boatloads of crazy people paddling away as if they were Red Indians on the warpath. The weather is quite cold, and our river is dangerous. It is silted up quite a lot, and there are, for the size of the river, immense sandbanks which channel the water through a narrow space and so increase its speed and set up whirlpools. We are always reading that someone has been drowned or fished out of the water, and yet people still go in it on old tires or anything they can dig up. Oh well, good for the funeral homes, I suppose. Now, I've got another question here which I have already answered, but I am going to answer it again in, possibly, a different form in order that someone may get a different slant on the thing. The question is, what is meant by the statement, "When the student is ready, the master appears"? Too many people think that they know all and plenty more besides. They think that they just have to whistle and hordes of masters come panting with eagerness to teach such a bright person. It doesn't happen that way at all. You know those kettles, you shove them on the gas or electricity, and when the water boils they let out a horrendous hoot. Well, people are like that. When their vibrations reach a certain pitch, that is, when they are ready, a master somewhere, either on the earth or in the astral, can pick up a vibration which says, metaphorically of course, "Hey boss, I'm ready, come and teach me all you know." So after the master has given a luxurious stretch and a hearty scratch, he might get to his feet, or even to his astral feet, and come along to give a hand. But nearly always the person who thinks that he or she is such a brilliant student that he or she is ready, well, they are the ones who just are not ready, and no matter how much they hoot or let off steam, until their vibrations reach the right pitch or frequency, no master will appear. So if a master doesn't appear, it is proof positive that you are not ready. Who is this? Astaremore. Okay Astaremore, here is your second question. How does race karma affect an individual? Before a person reincarnates to Earth, that person goes to what we may somewhat humorously regard as a travel agent in the astral. Actually it is a council of advisors. But the person who is going to come back to Earth knows what has to be done, where he or she has to go, and what the circumstances should be for doing that particular task or lesson. So one of the things is that one takes into account the basic karma of the race to which one is coming. One comes to a race whose karma is suitable for increasing one's opportunities for doing the allotted task. Apart from that, race karma doesn't affect one because it is more to do with the manu of the race. Well now, Esther Murray has another question here. She seems to be a nice young lady, so let's spare her a few more minutes, shall we? Her third question is, what can an individual do to reincarnate with the same family they now have, or is this not possible? I have just been telling you how things are planned. So if it is necessary for people to come together in another life, then they will come together in another life, and arrangements are made for that specific purpose. You might remember the case of the girl in India. She died as a child, and then she came back as a child to a family who lived just a few miles away, and she kept on talking about her other family. Many inquiries were made, and eventually the two families were brought together, and the reincarnated girl was able to give proof that she had reincarnated. That is a case which is authenticated beyond all possible doubt. Now, here is a question for you. Mermen and mermaids, were these truly a race of people, and if so, what intellect did they possess and what happened to them? Actually, all that the average person knows about mermaids and mermen goes back to the days of Atlantis. Now, Atlantis was a far more technically accomplished place than this present-day civilization. People could be made, lumps of protoplasm could be formed in somewhat human shape, and they were used as servants, not as slaves. They were used as servants because they were people of inferior mentality. They were, in fact, made for the purpose of serving their masters and mistresses. Theoretically, nowadays it is possible to increase the mentality of a dog or a horse or something like that by being irradiated by special rays and by being fed special chemicals. In that way, the brain voltages can be altered and so the intelligence factor increased. There is no reason, for instance, why monkeys should not be altered by chemicals so that their mentality is greatly increased, and thus they could, in effect, be a sort of servant to people. I know quite recently at the Calgary Stampede procession, when we had all manner of things going through the city streets, there was one monkey riding a horse, and he was wearing clothes. He was doffing his hat to the onlookers and behaving in every way the same as the humans around him. Except for looks, one couldn't have told the difference so far as behavior was concerned. And that old monkey, he certainly got a lot of applause, too. But then the applause upset his self-control because he jumped off the horse and jumped at the spectators, and he was horribly affectionate with them, and it was quite a task, I understand, to get him back on his horse again. You mentioned that in the astral world we can have families. Do we leave them for a while to attend class on Earth and then return to them at the end of our Earth class? Yes, that is quite possible. You may say that we spend 24 hours a day on Earth. Certainly we do, but they are Earth hours, and time in the astral world is utterly different from the time on Earth. In fact, in some of the Hindu books there are stories of people going away from the Earth and spending a little time in the astral, and then on their return to Earth finding that 1,000 years of Earth time has passed. So it is perfectly feasible for a person to come to Earth and do all manner of things by day. But the person has to sleep, and during the sleep the astral bodies go back to the astral world, no matter whether people remember rightly or not, and the time they spend in the astral world with their families may be perhaps twice as long as they stay on Earth by day. It is all a question of the difference in time. This next question makes me wonder if some poor soul has been brought up the hard way, because the question is, if a child were pushed through college in his life by a hard-hearted parent, would it necessarily help the child in his or her successive lives? Oh dear, dear, I am so sorry to have to disappoint you, but the answer is yes. Everything we learn, everything we experience is worthwhile, and it is saved. Now, a better way to explain it would perhaps be to say that when we go over to the other side, we take all the good that we have learned on Earth, and all the bad, the dross, is left behind. It's like if you are melting a metal, if you are melting gold, for instance, or silver, well, you melt the stuff and then sludge forms on the top. Because gold or silver is heavier than sludge, it forms as a dirty mass which is skimmed off and thrown away, leaving the gold or the silver to be poured into ingots. Well, we are in much the same state. All that which we have learned, which is of use to the overself and to our development, is retained. The bad is discarded like a bad memory. People are interested in the astral, aren't they? So here is another one about the astral. It is, if I were able to astral travel consciously and my wife had been trying without success, 1. Could I evaluate from the astral what she was doing wrong and help her to correct the situation? 2. Would it in any way be wrong to help in this manner? The answer is that of course you can go into the astral and find out what the problem is, and of course you can come back and tell her what the problem is. But I can tell you what the problem is now, it is just a matter of memory. She does astral travel.